Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio State University's Curwen Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity has a conference coming up in March. The title is Transforming Race, Crisis and Opportunity in the Age of Obama. We decided to invite one of the keynote speakers to join us today and was lucky that he could join us. Drew Weston is professor of psychology and psychiatry at Emory University in Georgia. He wrote The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. He also has founded his own political and corporate consulting firm and advises Democratic candidates, including the Barack Obama campaign for president. Drew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
You know, we were just listening to the new Quinnipiac poll on Ohio voters in the governor's race, and it always reminds me about polls, you know, that the politicians never believe in them if they're not winning in them. And, from covering politics over the years, that was always the litmus test. Do you believe it or not? No, then you must be losing. But polls are a relatively recent thing, and they have a lot to do with how we operate politically in this country now.
They sure do, and they've been in our political culture for about 40 years, and they perform all kinds of positive and have all kinds of positive and negative impacts on the way politicians operate and elections work. I think one of the most negative being that politicians are too quick to ask which way the wind blows, and too slow to ask the question that. I always ask when I'm doing consulting with either a politician or organization, which is when someone says, "Well, what do you think I ought to say on this?" My first question is always, "Well, first tell me what you believe." And once I know that, you know, the task is how do we talk about it with your constituents in a way that they'll be as likely as possible to agree with you.
It's kind of like that old mission statement issue. Do you know what you want?
Absolutely.
In your book, The Political Brain, Chapter 10 is titled Racial Consciousness and Unconsciousness. And since I just thought we could just jump in with that, since the topic of your keynote in March at the Curwen Institute is Assessing and Challenging Subconscious Racial Bias. Racial consciousness and unconsciousness, what does it matter as long as you act on your racial consciousness? Isn't that what we act on?
You know, that's the million-dollar question. And I think one of the ways that the way we talk about race in America is counterproductive is that we don't distinguish between what's conscious and unconscious. And what I mean by that is simply that, you know, we'll ask a question like, you know, remember a few years ago when Amadou Diallo got shot in New York City by the police, 41 times, mm-hmm. and he was reaching for something, and it turned out, to be his wallet for his identification. And it's very much like, actually, in some ways, like the case of Henry Louis Gates in Cambridge, although that one had some differences because he was fairly belligerent with the policeman after what I presume was a history himself of having years been, you know, asked for identification because he was walking in white areas when, mm-hmm. you know, when he was an educated black man. But the problem is that when you ask a question like, was that racist? Well, you know, black cops and Hispanic cops are often as likely to pull the trigger on a dark-skinned black defendant. Black suspect who isn't heeding their calls as white cops are, and that's not because they're consciously racist against. You would presume that a black policeman is not consciously racist against a black man who's running, mm-hmm. you know, from the scene of a crime where it doesn't stop. It's more about unconscious bias, and when you don't distinguish those, you end up really inflaming people by calling people racist who aren't consciously racist, and by not bringing the discussion to a level where we could really talk about it in a civilized way and speak to what our gut level feelings are as well as what our conscious values are, which are often very different.
When it comes to race, it's sort of like we're a nation of euphemisms. I was just talking to some folks about the YWCA, and in their mission statement, it's one of the big primary missions is to eliminate racism. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But that's sort of unusual. A lot of people want to say, hey, we have a black president now. It's really not as bad as it used to be. In fact, it may not be bad at all.
Now, it's a great point about euphemism, and you know, a great example of this is in the immigration debate, where the right is very smart in the way it talks about it. I happen not to like the way they talk about it because I think it is actually racist when you refer to people as. It's not racist to say someone is an illegal alien, but when you start dehumanizing people and just calling them illegals, you're really saying that they're not even people. You know, it's not about consciously saying I hate them because they're, you know, they're little brown people who don't speak my language. But if they were, you know, realistically, if illegal immigrants were mostly from Ireland, we'd be saying, well, you know, let's sit down in a pub together and figure out how to solve this problem, because there's 12 million of you have kind of overstayed your visas, and that's a few too many. We've got to figure out how to deal with it. So the response of people on the other side of immigrants' rights activists was to come up with a euphemism, undocumented workers. And the problem with that is that it is a euphemism. And I can actually tell you from polling people's responses to that is that the average American hears undocumented workers and rolls their eyes. They think, well, that's a euphemism. Why are they undocumented? They're undocumented because they're here illegally. So it actually makes more sense, and you do a lot better if you're talking to the American people from a standpoint of trying to figure out how do we actually solve the problem of 12 million illegal immigrants in the country. Call them illegal immigrants, and people actually are much less hostile. And they're certainly a lot less hostile than if you call them illegals or illegal aliens.
Yeah, and euphemisms are disliked because they feel unauthentic.
Absolutely, and it's one of the things that, you know, the right, what the right seems to understand, and they understand it on multiple issues, is that the best way to reach people is through their gut and is through associations, and by that I mean. What neuroscientists call a network of associations is an interconnected set of thoughts and feelings and images and metaphors and values. And so when you say illegal aliens, you're sort of eliciting associations to some mutant form of ET. You know, an alien is technically it's the term for someone who is here who's a stranger to the land. You know, who's not a citizen, but it also has a pejorative set of connotations to it, and that's why the right chose illegal aliens and then made it even illegals, which makes people not people. And that's not something that I condone. I wouldn't call it overtly racist. It's not, you know, it's not saying, you know, saying calling people names that are based on, you know, on the culture they came from. But it's clearly designed to activate those negative associations. And again, it doesn't activate associations to Irishmen who just happen to be white, and we have an easier time understanding them than we have understanding people whose native language is Spanish. So the left tends to think that the way to address these problems is, you know, these kind of issues is to, you know, list all the facts and that their 12-point plans for solving them, and that's what we really saw in healthcare over the last year, where the Republicans and conservatives said, this is a government takeover, this is socialism, this is a bureaucrat between you and your doctor. They're gonna take away, they're gonna have death panels. Those are all things that are designed to elicit emotions, and the Democrats responded typically either by not responding at all, which is the worst thing you can do in politics, because it gives the other side the ability to shape those networks of association to constitute public opinion however they want. But it also, if they did respond, they would respond with facts and figures. And those facts and figures are not nearly as powerful as the image of some board of bureaucrats deciding, well, who are we going to cover and not cover? You know, 80 years old, you got which kind of cancer? Are we going to pay for that or are we not? The death panel's idea that the way Democrats responded to it was, well, that's just silly. And in fact, I think that those were the president's words. The problem with that way of responding is that it is actually resonating with people for a reason. It is, in fact, a misleading and silly way to talk about it. We do have death panels now. They're called insurance companies. I mean, they actually make those decisions. So it would actually be a lot better, probably, to have a group of scientists sit down and say, well, let's look at least let's have the data out there so people can make decisions at the end of their lives about whether they really want to go through, you know, 9 months of torture to have an extra 4 months of life. But the conservatives who were talking about death panels were actually talking about something real, which is that a lot of the cost in the American healthcare system come from extraordinary procedures, end of life procedures that most people, if they had a doctor they trusted who sat down with them and put their arm around them and said, you know, Joe, here's what it looks like. You know, I can cut out your bowels, and you're going to have a colostomy bag, and the cancer's going to grow back. Or we can give you some medicines and have your family around you for the next 4 months and have you have a peaceful way out. Those are really your options, and you've got to decide. I can't make the decision for you, but that's a decision you've got to make. And if we had those kind of honest conversations, then words like death panels would have no power at all.
That death panel phrase, of course, originated with Sarah Palin. Was it her Facebook or a blog or some such thing? That old social media, that's had a big probably is another a whole other issue we can talk about. But Sarah Palin is a master of the punch in the gut phrase, and particularly for a neophyte. She's amazing at it.
You betcha, Ann. She's great at it. I'll tell you that I thought last week. I will say for the record, I'm not a Sarah Palin fan. I think she's George Bush in a skirt, and I think we had enough of George Bush. But she's actually a much better speaker than George Bush, and she's much better with colloquialism. She at least pronounces them correctly. That comment last week at the CPAC convention, you know, that conservative conference where she said something like, how's that Hopi change stuff doing for you? I mean, that captured a lot of public sentiment about what the last year has looked like, which was we were given a lot of hope. We were told there was going to be a lot of change. And so far, we haven't seen much hope. And we haven't seen much change, and so you know that it's actually a great example of the way conservatives who are good with words use them to evoke feelings that raise people's consciousness about the things that they're disenchanted about.
We're going to have to take a quick break. My guest is Drew Weston. He's the author of The Political Brain: The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. He'll be here in March to speak as a keynote speaker for the Kerwin Institute's Conference on Transforming Race, Crisis, and Opportunity in the Age of Obama. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News, and corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine at 247-4469. And thank you for supporting WOSU 820 NPR News. 31 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today, and a high this afternoon of 35 degrees. Clouds tonight with a slight chance of a little snow, mainly after midnight, a low of 22. And then we could see about a half an inch of snow on Wednesday, a high of 35.
Support for WOSU comes from Chamber Music Columbus, presenting Irish pianist John O'Connor, interpreter of classic and early romantic music, Saturday, March 6th at 8 p.m. at the Southern Theater. More at kappaandcmcolumbus.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest right now is Drew Weston. He is a psychology professor, a professor of psychiatry as well at Emory University in Georgia. He also wrote The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. If you want to give us a call or email us, 614-292-8513 or allsides@wosu.org. You know, Drew, I mentioned at the outset that you're obviously a consultant for Democrats. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that either. However, when I'm reading your book and your work on these topics, you're actually very critical of Democrats and how they handle the issue of the unconscious versus the conscious role.
Yeah. Actually, the book is actually a fun read for Republicans in some ways because it does detail many years of history of, you know, the Gore campaign and the Kerry campaign, and we've seen interestingly over the last year a return to that campaign style in the Obama presidency, even though he ran a campaign that looked more like Bill Clinton's, which is. You know, Bill Clinton was sort of remarkable fact. He's the only Democrat to be elected and reelected to two terms since Franklin Roosevelt, which was over 60 years ago. Which is, given that the electorate has been, in terms of party identification, people have been registered more Democrats than Republicans, or at least equal numbers for that entire time. It's a remarkable statistic, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that Republicans tend to understand the mind much better than Democrats.
Why do they? You've done clinical research on this. You've studied people's brains. Have Republicans necessarily done that?
No, they just tend to have a much better intuitive understanding of how it works. And I think, you know, people have asked me a lot of times, like, why do you get a Dukakis as a presidential candidate on the Democratic side? You know, someone who Bernard Shaw asked him a question in a debate. It's in the middle of a very tense time in his campaign where the Republicans have been running race baiting ads.
The Willie Horton
mm-hmm. ads, right? Showing this not accidentally dark skinned black man with an afro who looks to the average white person very much not like, quote, one of us, who had committed a violent crime before, was released on a furlough program. And promptly raped a white woman on her honeymoon in front of her husband. You can't hit any more hot buttons than that with an ad. The ad didn't, of course, mention that Ronald Reagan and George Bush had created a furlough program virtually identical to the program that Dukakis had created in Massachusetts. But that was the context for it. So then, you know, Bernard Kelb asks Dukakis the question, if your wife were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty? And Dukakis's answer has been, I think, really well summarized or paraphrased by Bill Maher, who said, whatever. And his answer was I remember it well. I've used it as a teaching tool many times. To talk to Democratic and progressive leaders and candidates about how not to do politics and how not to talk with people. His answer was, Bernie, that I've opposed the death penalty my whole career. I see no evidence that it's an effective deterrent or that it leads to any reductions in violent crime, and there are better, more effective ways of dealing with violent crime. When I remember seeing that and just screaming at the top of my lungs, no, you can't have said that. And the reason was that he believed the question he was being asked was a question about a rational question about the utility of the death penalty, when in fact he was really being asked a couple of questions. One of them was, are you normal? You know, do you have the normal feelings that a normal man would have if his wife were raped and murdered? And his answer to that question was, no, I'm abnormal. I mean, and that was a really bad way to start with the American people. The second question he was really being asked was the most important one in politics, which is a question voters ask all the time in hundreds of different ways, but they don't often ask it directly this way, which is, do you share my values enough that you could faithfully represent those values for me, in this case in Washington, as my president? And his answer really was no. And it wasn't no because the average American is for the death penalty. If you look at the way, say, Tim Kaine, when he was running for governor of Virginia, answered the exact same question. He was being attacked at the last minute in his campaign by sort of with a desperation attack by his opponent, saying that Tim Kaine is for the death penalty, is against the death penalty, and he'll let all these killers and rapists, he'll let them live, and et cetera, et cetera. And Kaine's response was, you can agree with me or disagree with me on this issue, but I'm a devout Catholic, and I believe the questions of life and death are best left to God. And so I'm not gonna make those kind of decisions on people. Although I will make sure that they stay in prison for the rest of their lives, and I'll leave it to our maker to make the final decision on them. And you know, you don't that was for the average Virginian. The average Virginian, I presume, about 80-85% of whom believe in capital punishment, said, you know what, I don't like where he's coming out, but I like the way he got there. You know, he recognized that it was a moral question,
mm-hmm.
and that's been the problem so much of the time with the way Democrats speak to the public, is that they don't start with values. Republicans always start with values. They always, you know, it's so easy to know what a Republican is, because if someone says, or a conservative is, if someone says, I'm a conservative, and I'm running for office, you can bet that they're going to say that they believe in low taxes, small government, low government spending, strong national defense, fiscal responsibility. That one didn't work out so well over the last 8 years. But fiscal responsibility. But they're brandishing that one as a weapon against Obama and everything he tries to do now. They're for a culture of life. They're for family values. They're for the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms anywhere, anyhow. And so you know that about Republicans right away. If you say, you know, I'm a Democrat, you have to brand yourself, because no one has any idea what that means.
Now, obviously, Barack Obama did a pretty good job of appealing to the values. There are other values besides Republican values.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, it's funny. He did a very good job in the sense that he appealed to the country was even before the stock market crashed. Unemployment was way up. The economy was in bad shape. There was a pervasive sense after Katrina, after the Iraq War, that we were just really on the wrong track. And then with the stock market crash, anyone who had run on the Democratic side would have gotten elected. But Obama did a terrific job giving people hope that it could be different. And the values that he ran on were largely the same values that Hillary Clinton and John Edwards spoke of, mm-hmm. but he spoke to those values and to that desire for hope and change in a way that was just much more emotionally powerful, which, you know, I think is fair to say that, you know, the difference between the reason we don't have President Hillary Clinton and the reason we have instead President Barack Obama was not a difference in their policies. Their policies were identical on every issue, except that I guess you could say he was he came out against the war first, and she came out for a mandate in healthcare first. I think those are the only two differences between them. And so, you know, if you were to make a rational assessment of which one of them actually had the experience, which one of them had been there longer, which one of them, you know, had the sort of the deep contacts in Washington to mm-hmm. know how to pull the right strings, you probably would have voted for Hillary. But it's a good example of how what he did was to tap into people's emotions and to basically give them a sense of hope. The thing that's, I think, been disconcerting to many people, including myself, who worked hard for his campaign and was a strong supporter, is that he abandoned all of those principles of communication in his first year in office and is just now starting to try to bring some of them back in. And the reasons for that are pretty difficult to figure out.
Yeah, you talk about the principles of communication. You're not talking about principles in general, but the principles of communication and the importance of how you communicate in terms of what your principles are in the first place. They don't matter if you can't communicate them.
That's exactly right. And again, you know, if you go back to something like healthcare is a good example. During the campaign, I did a lot of messaging headed up the messaging research for the major nonprofits that before and during the campaign were pushing healthcare reform, and you know, we had messages that we had tested that took the plans that basically were it was sort of a shared Obama Clinton Edwards plan. They basically all had the same plan with minor variations, and we boiled it down to a very small handful of basic principles underlying it. You know, principles like in this country, we are not going to let anyone go without health insurance. That if you like the health insurance you have now and you like the doctor you have now, we would never take that doctor or that health insurance plan away from you. And that we're going to use competition to make sure that that you have more choices rather than less, including people who right now have no choices. And that's going to include forcing the health insurance industry to compete with one plan, at least one plan that they don't get to control. And I can tell you that that message soared, especially if you didn't start it by saying, I believe in universal health care, which just elicits all of the, I mean, it is the most sterile way of talking about it and elicits all those associations to big government and to taxes and to bureaucrats standing between you and your doctor that the Republicans and Frank Luntz really capitalized on when he wrote this wonderful talking points memo for, you know, this memo of
last June, right?
Absolutely. And that memo single-handedly slew healthcare reform in America unless Obama is able to resuscitate it now. But if you started with, you know, I believe in universal health care, you would break even or lose with the average American. If you started by saying, I believe in a family doctor for every family, period, and then you said exactly the same policy principles, the same principles behind that, you'd win 70-30. And you can see the difference because one of them, when you say, I believe in a family doctor for every family, it tells voters where your heart is. It basically says, all right, I can picture that. It's vivid. It suggests, you know, to me, it suggests Marcus Welby, for those of us who remember, you know, are old enough to remember that. Or for younger people, I guess it might be the chief on Grey's Anatomy before he got into his alcoholism problem.
You know, or for the older among us, Dr. Kildare.
Exactly. We could certainly take this back to race, because this is an area where most of the arguments are actually not arguments of fact, they're arguments of values, and where actually most Americans have very similar conscious values. The average American today does not believe that you should discriminate against people based on race, creed, or color. In fact, in collaboration with a terrific pollster who I often work with, Celinda Lake, did some work in Georgia where we asked a question about that began with something like, we asked people if they would be more likely to vote for a candidate who said something like this. In America, we don't discriminate against anybody based on their race, their ethnicity, their gender, or their sexual orientation. And we even put in sexual orientation in a very conservative state. 85% of Republicans in Georgia Republicans in Georgia are like, you can see the 14th century from their front porch. They're not like Republicans in Ohio. Except maybe in some small southern Ohio towns, I guess you might find a few like them, but the Georgia Democrats tend to be somewhere slightly left of Republicans in Ohio, I suspect. But Georgia Republicans are pretty far right. So for them to endorse that at 85% tells you. I don't think it was just that they were lying. I mean, even if 85% of Georgia Republicans felt they needed to lie about that, that would tell you that there's been a tremendous attitude shift, that they would recognize that as an inappropriate thing to say, is that I think, you know, because somebody's white, they ought to get a job over someone who's black. And that's where I think we run into so much trouble in the way we talk about race in this country, is that the average person is not consciously racist, and the average person does not want to be consciously racist. And if the average person, if you said to the average person, well, you know, actually, you're doing some things that are discriminating against people, but you don't know about it. If you do it in a way that doesn't get them defensive, they're actually quite willing to listen to you.
If you're just joining us, my guest, Drew Weston, author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. In the start of the chapter 10 of the book, The Political Brain, you come out with the story about the Virginia senator who referred to the young man of Asian Indian descent as Makaka, And that's all interesting, but I was sort of stunned. I thought it was just going to be, you know, Drew Weston trashing, you know, what a horrible thing for a Republican to say about this young man. But the point was your observation about how the Democrat opponent responded, and it was stunning.
Well, that's right, and it was
not the response, but in your observation of it.
Yeah, well, you know, you actually probably remember the chapter better than I do at this point, because you just
read it last night.
Right, and I wrote it 3.5 years ago, so it's been a while. But the long and the short of it was that George Allen, the Republican senator who was heading for a presidential bid, sometime fairly soon in theaters near you, made the slip and referred to. Referred to a young man in the audience as Macaca, and it was clear that it was a racial slur, and there was really no other way to interpret it. And he tried to sort of weasel out of it in various ways. What was striking was that his Democratic opponent did not want to talk about it. He let the media do it for him, and he got really lucky that the media did it for him, because he actually didn't win by that many votes. I mean, now in the next election, I think he's proven himself to be the kind of senator that Virginians really like, and he's a very different kind of Democrat in many ways, including the fact that he was a former Republican. He's a very tough guy. But on this one, he was not tough. He did not want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, and that really reflects the conventional wisdom in Democratic circles, and that is that the best way to handle issues of race is to leave them alone, because fundamentally, if you talk about them, it just makes it worse, because the American people aren't with you. I've done a lot of research since the time that book came out for a number of nonprofit organizations, where we've looked at how do you talk with the American people about things like affirmative action, or about immigration, or about do we want to or not want to cover offer to illegal immigrants the ability to buy healthcare on the healthcare exchange if it gets created, if there's healthcare reform, and it turns out that actually talking with people about these things is much better if you want to see progressive changes than not talking about them, and not talking about them actually has the effect of leading to a sense of consensus that the public is against them.
We got to take a quick break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Now that the Conservative Political Action Conference and the National Tea Party Convention have wrapped up, we talk with journalist David Weigel, who covered both. He writes about the Republican Party and the remaking of the right for the online magazine The Washington Independent. Join us.
Fresh air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Be sure to catch Art Zine, Columbus's monthly art show, anytime online at wosu.org/artzine. On this month's show, go behind the scenes of a new exhibit at the OSU Urban Arts Space, showcasing 50 of the most intricate and colorful penny scales. And find out about a new film series at the Wexner Center about efficiency in the food industry. Art Zine gives you a firsthand look at the arts in action in Columbus. It's online at wosu.org/artzine. 32 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and a high of 35 this afternoon. Clouds tonight with a slight chance of a little snow after midnight, a low of 22 degrees. Cloudy for Wednesday with a few snow showers. We could see about a half an inch of accumulation, a high of 35 for Wednesday afternoon. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, Drew Weston. He's the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Drew will be working with the aforementioned Celinda Lake at the Kerwin Institute. We're going to post a link to the website to the Kerwin Institute so that you can get the details. Drew will be speaking on Saturday, March 13th at 12:30. Go to WOSU.org for more information about that. Let's take a call right now. If you'd like to talk or comment or question, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Rod, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Incidentally, you were talking about defining a conservative. I would add to that, you know, to his definition that these are people that basically don't care about the poor in the society. You know, people that have been unfortunate enough to, ended up on the wrong side of the, basically things have worked against them.
I would definitely agree with you, Rod, but I think that's probably not how they would advertise themselves.
Yeah. what I was going to suggest, it's always been my belief that through politics we set priorities for our society. And, again, this goes back to the question of winners and losers in a society, and the way we enforce our laws determines, again, who's the winner and the loser in a society. And basically people are out to defend their own interests. So I just wanted to get your comment on that.
Well, you know, it's a good question, and I think your broader point is absolutely right on, which is that politics is most fundamentally about defining what our priorities are, and that I've been a fairly vocal critic of the Obama administration, where I was a very vocal advocate before, and part of that reason is that I think that they really in the first year, and again, I think we're seeing some course corrections now, which I'm really pleased to see, but they've been one of the things they've really failed to do has been to define an alternative to the conservative philosophy the caller's talking about, which is basically, you know, every man for himself, let's have as small government as possible. Let's have as low taxes as possible. The only thing we should really spend on is the police, the fire department, and the military. And the problem with that is that what they're saying is that the government should exist only to protect our security. And what there's a big difference between that and a democratic or a progressive view, which says we actually don't disagree with that. We just define security more broadly, and that is that what we've seen in the last year and a half is that a small group of people can actually eliminate a third of the world's wealth and destroy all of our economic security, take away our health care benefits if we lose our jobs, which most people get their health care through their employment, and that protecting our economic security, protecting our the security threats that we face at home that are not often thought of as security threats, but I live in Atlanta, and Atlanta is now tied with L.A. for being the smog capital of the world again. Well, that's because we have an administration in Atlanta in the state government that doesn't believe in regulation of polluters. So those are the kind of differences between the two, you know, the two parties between more broadly a conservative philosophy and a progressive philosophy. That one of my frustrations with the Obama administration and its quest for bipartisanship is it's never said, you know what, there's two philosophies out there. One of them says is the philosophy of unregulated greed. It says, you know, if you just take the regulations off, let big businesses do what they want to do, everything will work out, we'll all get wealthy and prosperous. And it turned out we had a huge stock market crash, and now more than one out of 10 people in the state of Ohio and all over the country are out of work. So, you know, the president could easily have said, so we've learned that philosophy doesn't work. What a lot of people objected to that they resonated with Ronald Reagan on was the idea that, well, we don't want to have just keep pouring our taxes into government agencies and not making sure that those agencies are accountable to make things better or to be efficient. And you know, I don't know too many Democrats who disagree with that idea.
No.
Although in principle, it was often not done well. So it would have been a golden opportunity if the president had wanted to speak of bipartisanship to say, so here are the two philosophies. One says unregulated greed. The other says, you know, we need. The question isn't how big or how small government is. We need leaders who run our government well, and that means protecting us not only from foes from abroad, not only protecting us from criminals who wear ski masks, but also protecting us from criminals who wear blue pinstripe suits and work on Wall Street. And in fact, those criminals right now are far more dangerous to us than either the petty criminals a million of whom fill our jail cells. And not just petty criminals, there are plenty of violent mm-hmm. criminals, but you know, there are. You know, I think we've all seen what's happened when you don't take seriously the idea that the function of government is to protect us from all kinds of threats to our security, and that does include economic security.
Thanks, Rod, for your call.
Thank you.
You know, I wanted to go back to the comment that Rod made about Republicans, and that they don't, part of the description or definition of a Republican is that they don't care about other people that aren't as well off, or that, you know, that people should be picking themselves up by the bootstrap. You make and you agreed with them. You make a pretty salient point, though, in the political brain, that really when you get away from the euphemisms and deal directly with the gut issues that people care about, Republicans aren't necessarily against the kid down the street that doesn't have any shoes. They don't, you know, they like, you know, they want to help poor kids.
Right.
It was kind of an oversimplification. Maybe he was talking more about, I don't know, politicians. But even then, I think it's more complicated than that.
No, I think you're right. And I think my comment was overly glib. I think if you're drawing the distinction the core conservative philosophy is that we should be self-sufficient and that it isn't the job of government or your neighbors, unless they feel like it, to help you out unless you're in tough times, and that is the core conservative philosophy. It's, you know, we should use charity to
thousand solve. Points of light and that kind of a thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So if you want to solve a problem of poverty, use charity. The problem is that it doesn't work. I mean, there aren't enough charitable contributions, and particularly in tough times like this, when somebody else can destroy your livelihood and you have no recourse. That's a time when Republicans say, well, that's the brakes, and pull yourself up by your bootstraps and find yourself a job, and where Democrats tend to say that's the time when government needs to step in, regulate, create jobs programs, and let's put people back to work. And that is a fundamental difference between the party, between the two parties. There is a difference, I think, in if you look at the data the question, for example, of, you know, if you ask anyone, do you care that there are poor people? If you appeal to people, particularly, there's a core group of people on the far right who you can't actually make any kind of empathy appeal. So I've tried this in work with about 30,000 voters. There's a core group of about 30% who basically say, if you're poor, it's your problem, it's your fault, and deal with it. But most Republicans are actually reasonable people. Most Republicans consider themselves religious people, people of faith. Mm-hmm. They've read the same whether they're Christians or Jews or Islamic or whatever their religion. All of the major religions preach taking care of the poor, and so that's a value that's held consciously by all Americans. But this kind of gets us back again to, you know, the issue of what about unconsciously? Because in fact, in the minds of many people, whether it's conscious or unconscious, if you're poor, it means they are picturing inner city. Primarily people of color, and that's where you start to see the more unconscious biases mm-hmm. show up as opposed to our conscious values.
If you'd like to speak with or question Drew West and give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email us as usual. at allsides@wosu.org. And Michael, you're on the air. You want to ask Drew whether he has any sway with the president?
Yeah, and thanks for another great guest, and thank you for that follow-up question. I think that was very balanced, but I do want to remind you, listen to the Republicans on the fear-mongering about everything from health care to job to the stimulus. But, Mr. Weston, I have three questions. Do you have any sway with the Obama administration? Are you ever on MSNBC? And finally, what do you think about this past year with all the negativity from Fox and all those fearmongers? What do you think of journalistic advocacy when the country is in such a mess as we were, that, you know, Obama was given such a horrible situation? It's almost like you want the news media to rally around and help the president, you know? If you can answer those questions, I'd love it. Thank you, Ann, for a great guest.
Thanks, Michael, for your call.
Thanks.
Very, very good questions. In terms of do I have contact with the administration, I had a lot of contact with the at very high levels. I was a BlackBerry away from then candidate Obama for about 9 months during the campaign, and had a lot of back and forth, including at the time of his speech on race in Philadelphia, and I can reach the White House pretty easily at this point, although I've had some major differences with them in terms until finally it became clear that they couldn't continue to preach bipartisanship while the other side relentlessly attacked them. I kept saying you have to draw the distinctions between the parties, and you've got to, if these guys aren't going to join you, if you throw a bipartisan party, and nobody shows up, at some point you have to decide. And I think, frankly, the decision should have come after the stimulus bill, which was, you know, the president's first piece of legislation, when he conceded about $200 billion of it he knocked off a couple hundred billion. That most economists agreed could have prevented a lot of the job losses we've seen. And he switched a couple hundred billion that could have gone for infrastructure and for help to states, or for direct job creation the way Roosevelt did with the WPA. He switched that to Republican tax cuts, and then no Republicans voted for it. To me, that would have been the time when you say, you know what, I gave you your chance. You made clear that, you know, the same party that crash the economy has no intent to improve it, and so we Democrats are going to show you what it looks like when you follow the maxim that that politicians shouldn't be running for or against government. They should be running it well. We're going to show you what it looks like when it's run well and when it's run for the public interest.
He wants to get a bipartisan group together. Is it Thursday this week to talk about the health care? And the Republicans immediately came out and called it a trap.
Right.
I mean, one word that says a lot. One word.
Well, you know, and it's funny because in a funny sense, it is both a reaching out in a bipartisan way, and it is a trap because the president, frankly, when he wants to be a persuasive speaker, he is a phenomenally persuasive speaker, and there's really no one on the other side who can match him. And so, if I were the Republicans, I'd be pretty anxious about this summit coming up. But you're absolutely right. You know, the first response, instead of saying, "All right, we're gonna negotiate with you," was, "We're not even gonna bring a counter bill to the table, and we're not gonna acknowledge the fact that about a third of this proposal was actually originally actually John McCain's proposal." I mean, this is as much McCain's proposal as it is Obama's at this point.
Let's take an email. If you'd like to email us, go to allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from a listener. Public policy issues and solutions are often complex and nuanced. How do we talk about a program or policy without being simplistic, but still stating important values and ideas? This goes to that rational, emotional thing.
That is a terrific, terrific question. And it's one that I get asked all the time by Democratic leaders, candidates, politicians, And that is, you know, the positions on the right are often very easy to summarize with one word. You know, guns, good. Abortion, bad. Taxes, bad. Government spending, bad. I mean, it's kind of caveman speak, and it's not difficult to do. If George Bush was sort of the prototype of this, of a Manichaean thinker who really saw things in black and white and was just, you know, there's one right way, and it was his way, and you're either with us or you're against us. That was kind of the, you know, it sort of sums up that philosophy. And again, I don't want to stereotype the way that you pointed to before, because I think it's a really good point. Is that most of the work that I do now as a consultant is I talk with voters in the middle, slightly right of center, slightly left of center, dead center. And what I find is that they share a whole set of values that pretty much all Americans share. I mean, we all share values like personal responsibility, which is a value that is more often talked about by politicians on the right than politicians on the left. And it's something that President Obama has made a point of talking about repeatedly. Unfortunately, he hasn't demanded it of anyone. I mean, we haven't seen anybody on Wall Street prosecuted for, you know, the crimes that cost so many people their jobs and their homes. But he's at least talked about it. Accountability is another one of those kind of values. Hard work is another one of those kind of values. And the best way to talk with voters in the center is actually not to try to craft centrist policies. It's to talk to the values in the heartland, in the center. And Ohio is a place whenever I do focus groups, that's the first state I want to go to, because that is the sort of the center of America. That's where you see what the average American is thinking and feeling. And by and large, those values in the center, whether they're center right or center left, have done a lot of good things for us, and they're the values of the middle class. I've now just lost the question that was asked. It was a great question.
That how can we – things are complex, that policy matters are complex, and how can we simplify them without – I guess, you know, I'm going to paraphrase – without dumbing it down. And that was that kind of that rational – you know, you kind of – in the book, at least, you talk about how Democrats deal with things kind of in a rational level, like, well, don't you want to hear what our plan is? Republicans go for the gut.
Right. And this is where what I've learned through essentially conversations with about 30,000 voters since I wrote the book, where I'll do a lot of I do some focus groups, but do a lot of online testing of messages to see, you know, if your goal is immigration reform that is sensible, that will deal with the fact that we have 12 million people in this country who've been here, most of them for many years, many of them married to American citizens, many of them with children who've known no other country than America. At the same time, they came here, they either overstayed a visa, which is actually the case with most of them, or they crossed the border illegally. What do we do about that? What I typically do for much of the work is for nonprofits, but also for candidates, is that simply help them enunciate their values clearly. And the thing that I've learned over and over and over again is, if you just talk to Americans like grown-ups, if you speak to their ambivalence, they're much more likely to trust you, and with good reason. So let me give you an example.
Well, you know what? I wish we could. But we're out of time, Drew.
I guess people will just have to read the book then.
And I'm sorry to all my callers and my emailers. We weren't able to get to them. Drew Weston, author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Go to WOSU.org/allsides for more information about when Drew is going to be here in March. Thank you, Drew, for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me on.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.